The following podcast is a production of Institutional Real Estate Incorporated. For the most comprehensive industry news and information, visit our website at irei.com and sign up for our free daily news alerts.
Welcome to the Dorman Report for April 2018. Jeff Dorman with Mike Consul here. One of the things that we have been observing for some time now, and it seems to be picking up a little bit more steam, is the movement of institutional managers into the private wealth space. Jeff, what are the dynamics that have been at play that are encouraging institutional players to start looking much more seriously at private wealth?
Well, I think there's a number of factors that are going on here. One of the things that's certainly driving it is the recognition and realization that, you know, defined benefit pension market continues to shrink year by year by year, and the defined contribution market expand. Now, one way to solve for that is to develop products that go into the defined contribution pension fund market, and people have been working on those products. There's really two ways in which to put product together for that right now. There may be others developing along down the road, but one way is to offer some kind of real estate option that can get inserted into a cafeteria type choice plan, where the plan sponsor is providing their participants with multiple options: mutual funds for fixed income, mutual funds for income, international mutual funds, equity mutual funds, and then some liquid alts, you know, REITs and other things, or perhaps even some illiquid investments. They may have a way of, you know, aggregating that capital and channeling it into an open-ended fund. So that's one way people are developing product for the market. Another way people are developing product for that market is increasing into larger defined contribution pension plans are developing what they call custom target date funds. In other words, they're not going out and buying Vanguard's, you know, target date funds or what have you. Their internal staff on the defined contribution pension fund side of the business, not the same people on the defined benefit side of the business, are developing basically a series of different kinds of target date funds custom designed to meet the needs of the plan participants, and the plan participants can choose one or a multiple numbers of those target date plans to match up with their objectives. In both cases of that, the choice to move into those plans is either made individually by the investor or the participant, or is based on a recommendation that their personal financial advisor has made. So that market in itself is kind of touching on the private wealth advisory distribution channel and the individual investor market. But some of these funds also have, or fund managers have also decided that another interesting channel is the private wealth advisory marketplace, or the what a lot of people are calling the RIA channel, the Registered Investment Advisor channel, or the broker-dealer channel. And part of what's happened in that marketplace is it's gone through a huge upheaval. Jennifer Dorman Alpert, who runs our Real Asset Advisor publication, could tell you that there's just been a tremendous amount of strife in that marketplace. One of the things that's going on is there's been a fiduciary rule proposed by the Department of Labor, which normally doesn't regulate in the securities market, that registered investment advisors must operate the way prudent person of like means and like circumstances would operate, the same kind of standard they set up in ERISA. And while you would think that that would be just a foregone conclusion that an advisor would be bound to put the interests of their clients first, the problem comes not from the philosophy, which I think most registered investment advisors would embrace. The problem comes from the legal interpretation implications of it all. You know, for example, is it okay for an advisor to sell a product with a high front-end load, as many of these programs have in the past have had? Is that a good thing to be doing, or are they doing it because of the fees? Is that really in the best interest of the client? And then the other question you have is, if an investment advisor, a private wealth advisor, is recommending that a client be invested in illiquid investments, how do they justify the fees that they're charging on those assets? So let's say somebody had a $25 million portfolio, and typically the advisor would recommend 10% of that into illiquid alternatives, including real estate. Under the rule, it's questionable as to whether or not, or some people's interpretation of the rule, it could be questioned as to whether or not that advisor is acting in the client's best interest by charging a fee on something that he really can't do anything about once the person goes into the investment. So there's all these issues floating around, and what it's done is it's put the damper on the sale of traditional products that typically have had front-end loads or front-end fees or distribution costs somewhere in the neighborhood of 8 to 10%. So the broker-dealers themselves are worried also because of the fiduciary rule, because they now are worried about being sued by clients who go into illiquid investments and don't end up getting the results that they had hoped to get. And, of course, the broker-dealer is simply selling the product. They don't really have any control over the performance of the product. And so that slowed down a number of broker-dealers from even wanting to continue to offer, you know, these illiquid products to their investors. So in the climate of all of this, you have to understand what that marketplace is made up of. It's a much smaller market than the market that the institutional investment managers have been serving, in the sense of not the dollars at stake. The dollars at stake are actually much larger than the institutional market. But in terms of the players that are providing alternatives to that market, very many of them are relatively small. I mean, a lot of these players, if you go to a DISA meeting or to an IPA meeting, a lot of these investment managers really are struggling to get to $1 billion under management. And their track records really stretch back maybe 5 to 6 years, some of them 10 years, but not much more than that. So what the institutional investment managers sense is an opportunity to move into a marketplace that's somewhat in disarray, offer a much lower cost product to that market. Maybe they charge no fees, or maybe they charge fees in the range of 3.5%, which is about the bottom line of what a broker-dealer would require in order to distribute a product. And or they're coming in with products that they call spread fee products, you know, that basically take that fee and spread it over a course of 3 consecutive years so that the initial impact isn't so great. Another thing that around this whole fee issue is there have been rules introduced that require these product sponsors to disclose the impact of fees on the confirms that investors receive. It used to be that if investors signed a subscription for, say, $10 million or $5 million or $2 million, what it would show in the confirm is that they invested $10 million. But now they have to say, if there's an 8% load, they have to say that they've really invested, you know, $9.2 million, because $8 million of it, or 800,000 of it, went to the load. And so this is changing again the willingness of some distribution channels to want to distribute this product, because all of a sudden it's clear to the investor that, you know, some of their money is really going to pay for the distribution cost. And the other thing that's happened is when you charge those high fees, you're somewhat at a disadvantage, because you no longer are competing with people. Like in the institutional market, you might have 100% of the money that you're raising available to invest. In the retail marketplace, you might have 9.2 cents on the dollar to invest. And so, I mean, 92 cents on the dollar to invest. And so you're kind of at a disadvantage going in, and you have to make up the difference with leverage. So what's happened to a lot of these programs is they really haven't delivered on their promise. A lot of these programs also had promised the investors that they would provide them with a 6% dividend. What they didn't disclose, in many cases, was what the composition of the dividend was going to be, because given that they're going in at a disadvantage because of the load, it's really hard to generate the kind of current cash yields in the early years of the program to cover the dividend. And so what they would do is they would put a reserve pool aside, and they would basically be paying the investor supporting the dividend by supplementing the cash flow from the investment with a portion of a payout of the reserve pool, which is really just a return of the investor's capital. And of course, the broker dealers and the advisors are saying, look, you're getting all this tax advantaged investment. But yeah, part of the reason you're getting tax advantaged investment is because of the depreciation deductions that you can absorb. But the other part of it is you're getting a return of your capital, and so the return of your capital isn't taxed. But a lot of investors didn't really understand this, and so the performance didn't live up to it. So now these big institutional investment managers are looking there and going, we've got a great track record. We've been around for 20, 30 years. Our track records extend 20 and 30 years. We've got these huge, massive, you know, infrastructure that we've built to support investment management. We've got access to deals. And we've proven that we can perform over time. And if we can come in and deliver a lower-cost alternative solution to the investment management world, or to the private wealth advisory and the individual investor world, that should be welcomed with open arms. And in fact, it has been. You know, in the first year that Blackstone entered the market, for example, they became the dominant capital fundraiser and scooped up a disproportionate share of the capital. It was the strength of the Blackstone name, the strength of the Blackstone platform, and it drew a lot of attention. Other players like LaSalle and Deutsche Asset Wealth and Management have been doing this for a number of years as well, and have substantial amounts of money from that marketplace. Recent entrants to the marketplace include firms like Starwood and T.H. Nuveen. And there's a number that are planning products for the marketplace, including Principal and Baring and Madison International. And then, you know, smaller firms even, like Argosy, have raised a disproportionate amount of their capital from the private net worth, high net worth, and family office market. So there's a lot of interest starting to focus on this market. It's a wide open interest, a wide open market, because anytime a market is in trouble, anytime a market is in disarray, anytime a market is being reorganized, there's an opportunity to come in and really take significant market share. Having said that, there are some strong players from the old days in the marketplace. Inland would be one. Another one would be Griffin Capital. And a handful of others that really have been able to make, you know, a substantial presence in that marketplace. So it is interesting to watch, though, because this market is going through a lot of changes.
You know, we just recently did a podcast about Brookfield. Brookfield just recently acquired Center Coast Capital Holdings, a $4 billion infrastructure play. They have MLPs. They're in the midstream space for energy. And so Brookfield was excited because this is going to give them access to the retail market for infrastructure. And Central Coast was excited because it's going to give them access to the institutional side of the business, which they have not been able to access. So another example of what you're talking about is, you know, well, a big player like Brookfield moving into the space. Go ahead, Jeff.
Well, Lionstone also was just acquired by Threadneedle, and Threadneedle is part of the Ameriprise distribution network, and therefore not only does Ameriprise Threadneedle get access to institutional level real estate investment management capacity, but it also provides Lionstone with access to the individual investor market as well. So undoubtedly, they'll be developing product for distribution to that market eventually down the road too. So, you know, there's just a lot going on right now, a lot of change. And, you know, I look at it as the early, it's very similar to the early days when I first started out in the institutional market, you know, 40 years ago, when things were just getting started and people were trying to figure out how to access this market and how to develop a marketing approach and a capital fundraising, you know, team back in those days. So it's an exciting place to be. It's very interesting.
So how far along do you think this is right now, Jeff? Are we in the first, second, third inning? Or are we seventh inning stretch? I mean, it seems that there's a lot of institutional players who haven't made the move yet. So how far along would you say we are?
I think we're in the bottom of the first. I mean, think about it. You know, Deutsche and LaSalle have been doing this now for 3 or 4 years. Clarion came into the market and then put it back on the shelf because they were having some difficulty getting traction. Timing is everything. But now they're coming back out with a product again and starting to move in that market, direction of that market again. I just think, you know, it's very, very early. There's plenty of room for people to come into the market. And it's a wonderful thing because what it will do is it will take all those, it will wash some of the mom and papas out. people that really can't perform because they don't have the capacity to scale their businesses up. But it will also take the ones that do have the capacity to scale their business up. It'll help lift them, too, because, you know, rising tide will lift all boats. So it will really be interesting to see what happens. And most important, what really hinges on the success of this whole thing is keeping the fees low and keeping the performance up. If you can deliver a low-cost, better-performing vehicle than what people have been provided in the past, which was, in a sense, a high-cost, poorly-performing vehicle, you're going to be able to really develop a lot more investor loyalty and investor interest and advisor interest in recommending these products. So I'm very hopeful. I think all these things that are happening are really, really good things.
So what about the RIAs that are out there that are not of a significant scale, that are, like you say, struggling to get to a billion, or they might only be a couple of billion? Are you anticipating that there'll be a major shakeout? I mean, we've seen a lot of consolidation, I think largely driven by both the regulations and the technology arms race, so to speak. Is this going to mean that the number of RIAs is going to diminish by a great number?
No, I don't think so. I think what's really happening, the real trend, and Jennifer could talk more to this than me, that the real trend is that the broker-dealers are losing and hemorrhaging registered reps to the RIA channel. You know, it's in a broker-dealer environment. You know, it's first of all commission-driven, all right, or mostly commission-driven. There's a lot of hybrid people that are charging fees and taking commissions. But, you know, you can only sell what's on the platform. And the move for a lot of these people is to move towards a more independent status as a registered investment advisor, independent, to be able to make their own decisions about what to put in the platform. But the other side of it is, it doesn't alleviate them as registered investment advisors from the responsibility of doing good due diligence. And so there are service companies that are evolving to help, you know, help provide the due diligence services that most of these smaller RIAs can't really provide because they don't have the platform and the revenue stream to be able to support the platform that they need in order to do that part of the job. So again, that part of the business is all in flux and up for grabs, and lots of stuff happening there as well. There's also, as the more experienced RIAs that have been around for a long time get older too, they're also moving towards retirement. So there's a lot of M&A activity going on, and a lot of these advisors are getting bigger through mergers and acquisitions, which is always tricky because, you know, the client relationship really flows not from the client to the firm so much as it does from the client to the registered rep or the advisor. And so, you know, just because you buy somebody's firm doesn't mean the clients are all going to transfer over. It also doesn't mean all of the registered reps will transfer over because, quite frankly, or the registered investment advisors will transfer over because if the advisors don't like the new parent, they're just going to spin out and go someplace else. And with them typically goes all the clients, even though theoretically the client relationship is owned by the company. In reality, in practice, the client relationship is owned by the individual advisor. And usually the clients follow the advisor, not the company.
So let's talk about regulations for a minute. I was talking to the head of a $34 billion RIA, and he was talking about how irrational the regulatory regime is right now. And I said to him, well, what would make it rational? He said, well, number one, everyone has to be a fiduciary. Number two, advisors are forbidden from receiving commissions on investment products, so that eliminates an inherent conflict of interest. And number three, an advisor cannot be paid to recommend his or her own funds because that's obviously a conflict of interest. And he says you eliminate those three things and you solve 95% of the problem. And those are just a few simple regulations. You've been in that regulatory environment, in and around it, Jeff, your whole career. What do you think of that?
Well, there's a lot of unintended consequences that occurs with that, okay? There aren't a lot of advisory companies that recommend their own products, but the fact that they would recommend their own products is not necessarily a conflict of interest. The theory behind recommending your own product offering is that you therefore have some control over the performance of the underlying product. And if you have confidence in the quality of platform that you have built to manage those investments, you actually might be better serving the client by providing your own in-house products than not. It depends on what's driving the decision. If the decision is being driven by the desire to serve the client's interest and deliver the performance the clients need, then it's the right motivation. If the decision is to simply generate more fee revenue, then it's the wrong decision. So, you know, the problem is you can't regulate or legislate intentions. And the real issue behind these you know, proposed rules or rules would be, what is the intention of the player? Is the intention to do what's in the best interest of the client, or is the intention to rape and pillage the client and steal as much money from the client as you possibly can? And I don't know. To me, it's almost like trying to figure out how to create the most perfect alignment of interest. You know, if you pick the right people who really want to operate as fiduciaries, it doesn't matter what the documents say, they're going to do the right thing. But if you pick the wrong people, again, it doesn't much matter what the documents say, they'll find a way to get around it and take your money. So what you really need to do is you need to find the right people, no matter what you're doing. And I don't think there's a regulation that's going to make that happen. The industry itself needs to grow up and recognize its fiduciary responsibilities and take them seriously. And a lot of advisors do. But I think, to a certain extent, they should be self-policing and, you know, disclosing when they uncover somebody who's not operating in the best interest of the clients. That's really what should happen. So I don't know that regulation is ever going to solve this problem. What's going to solve this problem is culture. And the industry has a culture challenge. And the challenge is to develop a culture that is self-policing, that will lead to always placing the interest of the investor first. That's really what needs to happen. And meanwhile, people will continue to introduce regulations, and they'll continue to have the law of unintended consequences at work, which means those regulations will continually be subject to modification. And that's just the way things tend to unfold and tend to work. It's interesting that these new regs are being introduced in a period of time when the White House and the Republican party that seems to be in control of the House and the Senate right now are dead set on reducing regulation, not increasing it. So it's kind of a ironic thing that, you know, right at the time when most effort in the White House and on Capitol Hill has been towards deregulation, that these additional very stringent regulations, and I have to admit, pretty ambiguous regulations, are being introduced into the private wealth advisory market. In the long run, it'll be a good thing, because in the long run, it will drive that fiduciary culture, which is really is the issue at hand.
As you know, there is a difference between making rules, putting regulations in place, and enforcing those regulations. I mean, during a Democratic administration or Republican administration, oftentimes the regulations are the same, but the Democrats get in there and they enforce them, over-enforce them, some might argue, and the Republicans get in there and they kind of back away from that and let business conduct itself to a fault, some argue. So obviously there's extremes on either side of that, but it does seem curious, though, that the regulations are actually being put into place during an all-Republican Congress and White House. So your point is well taken.
It's a reaction to bad performing products that were introduced and that investors have been, you know, pushing back against, and consequently they put pressure on their legislators to do something about the distribution of these products that aren't really in their best interest. And again, I don't want to, you know, paint the whole industry with the same brush. It's really a handful of players that have really not been good guys who have, either because of ineptitude or because of willful malice, have gone out and developed products that really were bad performing products. You know, delivering investment results is not easy. I mean, it really is not. Doing it consistently year in and year out is really not easy. And that's in the good times. I mean, when you have big market corrections, the whole thing is preserve capital, preserve capital. And that's usually the best you can hope to be able to do. And a lot of times you'll lose capital, but you'll gain it during the market recovery cycle. And the key is not to panic and be forced into selling off assets at the most disadvantageous time. But it does wreak havoc with your track record when you have these huge, huge dips. I remember being at a local meeting here in Northern California, speaking to a big group of advisors, and I showed a chart showing how the NCREIF returns had performed over time, and all they focused on was the huge dip during the global financial crisis. Now, you know, the equities market had just as severe a dip, if not more, but it recovered faster. You know, real estate markets tend to collapse all at once, but take a long time to recover. And, you know, they really didn't understand the dynamics of what they were looking at. And that in itself was kind of surprising, because you think these guys would be extremely well-versed in, you know, financial theory and understand ups and downs, all those sorts of things. But in fairness, think about the training that most of these guys get. I mean, probably they had a degree in finance or in business, you know, with an MBA or a Master of Finance. There's nothing taught about alternatives or real estate or anything in any of those courses. And if there is, it's really more from a corporate facility standpoint and less from an investment standpoint. There are real estate programs at these schools, but the people that go through the real estate programs typically end up with a career in real estate, not in personal financial advising. And so, you know, there's no curriculum there. If you go in and take CFA curriculum, there's almost no curriculum on alternatives. If you go in and take the CFP, Certified Financial Planner curriculum, there's almost no curriculum oriented towards alternatives in real estate. If you even take a licensing program like Series 6 that is all about direct participation programs, it's all about the structure of the program. You know, what is a limited partnership? It has nothing to do with the underlying assets that these direct participation programs are structured to deliver to the investor. And so there's no place anywhere in their world where they get exposed to this kind of information. And then, you know, you take a look at the publications that they're reading, from the Wall Street Journal to Barron's to Fortune Magazine to Forbes Magazine to the specialty magazines like Estates and Trusts and, Financial Planner, Financial Advisor, Investment News. These are the publications the advisors read, Registered Rep Magazine. None of them have anything about alternatives, or if they do, it's usually negative. So there's nothing that's helping them understand the case for investing in alternatives. There's nothing that's helping them understand, you know, how to monitor the performance of their investments and benchmark them against other indices. There's nothing that helps them understand what products are available in the marketplace. And quite frankly, that's exactly why we developed the Real Asset Advisor magazine publication, is to fill that information gap, fill that education gap, fill that benchmarking gap that was in the marketplace. And now we're seeing other players come along doing similar things. So, you know, we're starting to get competition already, which tells us that our original thesis that there was a need for this kind of information was probably right.